Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Laveau. Zelensky says Kyiv does not want to prolong the war and make it last for years. He's even suggested using intermediaries to achieve that end. At the same time, Kyiv pleads for greater NATO involvement. As usual, Zelensky is stuck between a rock and a hard place. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Dan Kovalik in Pittsburgh. He is a professor of law and the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. And in Kyoto, we cross to Pascal Lotas. He is an associate professor at Kyoto University. Our gentleman, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Pascal, let me go to you here. We've had a flurry of comments coming from the former president of Ukraine, Zelensky. He's no longer legally the president, even under the constitution of the country. But, you know, he's talking about he doesn't want a prolonged war. He doesn't want to have it last for years, looking for intermediaries, possibly another peace summit after the failed first one, which could include Russia. But at the same time, he wants a no-fly zone over western Ukraine, obviously always asking for more aid, all kinds of aid, particularly financial aid. Ukraine is facing international default immediately. It's very soon now. They're in very big financial troubles here. Is there an attempt to change the narrative? Is there an attempt to change course on how to end this conflict? How do you read it? Because it's kind of all over the place. Pascal.
Honestly, like when you reached out to me yesterday with that article, I tried to find the original source. I had trouble to locate it. And what I found was Mr. Zelensky's explanations of how they still want to defeat Russia and how the only right peace is a just peace according to the Ukrainian peace formula, and that's something that he said 2 or 3 days ago. At the same time, it is very much possible that this kind of talk from him, this rhetorical shift, is also happening at the moment Mr. Zelensky. I just don't know what is the case and who is currently in charge of what he is saying. He has been consistently talking out of both sides of his mouth, which is very different from what we've heard from Vladimir Putin, Russia has had a very consistent narrative, actually, with what they wanted. So the one thing that I'm waiting for is for either Mr. Zelensky or Joe Biden or somebody in the West to actually start picking up Russia on its offers for real peace negotiations, which would, and we know that by now, we know that for 2 years, the main pillar of that would be Ukrainian neutrality. So as soon as somebody starts saying, we are again serious about contemplating Ukrainian neutrality, as Mr. Zelensky was 2 years ago, during the Istanbul negotiations, then I will start believing that something is really moving. And until and unless that happens, I do think it's just more rhetoric out in the ether in order to, you know, satisfy the demands of newspapers in different parts of the Western world.
Yeah, and to keep the Ukraine story at the top of, keep it as a headline here. You know, Dan, it's interesting what Pascal said, you know, because the legitimacy of Zelensky in Ukraine is quite questionable. But after the dementia debate, one has to wonder who's running the show in Washington, D.C. I mean, more ambiguity going. I was going to, you know, I've many times in this program called it Biden's war and things like that. I mean, well, I don't know if it is his war, but I don't know whose war it is at this point here. I mean, again, it gets more and more convoluted. If this is Biden's policy, well, we saw from the debate, we really don't know what he's talking about most of the time. And so who in the administration is deciding these things? There's one layer of mystery after another. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, well, I think certainly Antony Blinken is a big player in all this. Victoria Nuland had been. I guess she's gone now out of the administration. I don't know, but she's maybe lurking behind the shadows. You raise a good point. I mean, the guy who, I guess, has his finger on the nuclear button is completely absent. You know, they say that he's just not there. No one's inside that body, you know, and it's a very sad and again, but it's very dangerous because it means there's unelected officials for sure, like a Blinken, who are really in charge. And these are neocons who want war. And really, I've said before, you know, every president since World War II has seen one of their main tasks as preventing nuclear holocaust, you know, protecting Americans from World War III if they did anything else, right? This administration seems to want World War III. And I think part of that is that you do not have a chief executive, a functioning chief executive at the helm to check these crazies. The crazies are in control. And, you know, it makes me very afraid.
It makes me very afraid, too, Dan. You're absolutely right. Ever since the Second World War, the primary mission of the chief executive of the United States is to avoid a nuclear holocaust here. But, Pascal, we have with this administration, they seem to have rejected the idea of deterrence, of nuclear deterrence. And this is what, you know, they talk about who's saber rattling, but it's really the West that is doing it because they no longer play by the rules of deterrence. I mean, the United States and the Soviet Union were ideological opponents, okay, and they kept the peace. There is no ideological difference here, except for, I would say, the West is far more ideological. But if you don't play by the rules of deterrence, that's the nightmare scenario. Pascal.
They don't believe in deterrence anymore. They believe in one-way deterrence. They do not perceive Russia as somebody who has a legitimate reason to do deterrence. To me, the West is so full of itself at the moment that it has lost all capacity for strategic empathy. Trying to understand what the world looks like from your opponent's viewpoint is a basic necessity of any sane foreign policy making. And the last 30 years of utter unipolar moment has taken that away. So people like Mr. Blinken and others, they are literally not able to perceive anymore the world from the viewpoint of the Russians. And therefore, they don't factor that in. Therefore, they think constantly Russia is bluffing. Yes. They do not think it's real. And this is a super huge problem. Yes. And it might land us in a nuclear holocaust if it continues, because the Russians are not bluffing. I don't believe Russia is bluffing.
Well, but Dan, because from Russia's point of view, this is existential. I mean, we have an incoming foreign affairs czar for the European Union, Kallas. She wants the breakup of the Russian Federation. It's pretty existential, don't you think? I mean, and the Russians do believe in deterrence. And if you don't, if you have all of this ambiguity in decision making, it's going to make you apprehensive at the very, very least. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Russians do have an existential threat. You know, the fact that these radar systems in Russia were attacked by Ukraine that have nothing to do with defending against Ukraine, right? They were created under the Soviet Union so that they could perceive strikes from intercontinental ballistic missiles from the United States. So, of course, Russia has to say, are you destroying these radar systems so you can have first strike capability against us? I mean, that would be a rational conclusion to be drawn. Meanwhile, you have Biden saying Ukraine can use U.S. and Western weaponry to attack Russia deep within its territory. You have this attack on Crimea, on Crimean civilians recently, which may have used U.S. weaponry and reconnaissance. How could, you know, if the shoe were on the other foot, if Cuba, and, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, this was a possibility, was using Russian technology to attack targets within the United States to kill beachgoers in Miami, the U.S. would immediately respond. I mean, and how do we know that? John F. Kennedy said that that's what we would do. So, obviously, Russia is under existential threat, and frankly, Russia has to be applauded for its incredible restraint in the face of all this.
Well, Pascal, that's, you know, we know that the defense minister here spoke to the Secretary of Defense in the United States for the first time, I think, in 16 months. And we don't know what the readout is, but I can well imagine is that get your drones out of the Black Sea. And of course, not threatening, but saying there could be consequences if they stay. Okay, again, being very restrained. Pascal.
That's maybe the only positive out of this, that it seems that for the first time, these casualties at the beach in Sevastopol actually managed to worry people in the U.S. in the highest levels, the Secretary of Defense, to actually say, like, we need to signal that this was not intended. And that's actually something I believe. Probably this is something that, at least from the U.S. side, might not have been intended. And maybe I'm being too gracious here. Maybe it was. But it looks to me as if, though, this might have been a genuine kind of accident, like real collateral damage. And if the U.S. for the first time understood that they might have crossed a line, then maybe we are getting closer to a point where strategic empathy, as I just said, is again on the table, which is the minimum needed
in order to get to real discussions. I won't be so generous, because if drones are being shot down over the Black Sea, then the United States is going to have to reply. And do they really want to go up the escalation ladder? The ball will be in their court. Pascal, quick before we go to the break.
Recently, we have seen that the United States, when push comes to shove, they actually walk back from the brink, as with Iran. I do think the same still goes for Russia. All-out Third World War is not in the interest of the U.S., and they do walk it back sometimes, and I hope it's the case also this time.
Well, we have to keep our fingers crossed here. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle Trumanji. We're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Dan in Pittsburgh here. Dan, it's been reported that Foreign Minister Lavrov had a conversation with the U.S. ambassador here in Moscow, and the readout is pretty simple. We are no longer at peace. Very interesting statement. How do you interpret that?
Well, first of all, he's stating the obvious, that the U.S. is engaged in a proxy war against Russia. There's no way to interpret the situation any differently. So first of all, Lavrov is simply stating what the world, you know, recognizes. But obviously, what he also is saying in that is a warning. He's saying that, look, we're not going to sit around and continue to not respond to this, and that you, the United States, is going to be a target if you continue to attack the Russian heartland, and you continue to threaten Russia existentially, we will have to respond. We haven't responded so far against any United States targets, but that day may be coming soon. And I do hope the U.S. gets that message.
Well, Pascal, I mean, obviously, the NATO is baiting Russia into responding in a way that they can point the finger that the Russians are escalating. The Russians haven't taken the bait thus far. But there's a wide variety of things that can happen. Satellites being destroyed, drones being destroyed. I mean, it'll be hard to make the argument, you know, Article 5 has to be invoked, okay? So, I mean, this is what makes it very, very tricky as we see both sides in parlaying.
That's absolutely true, which is why this is such a dangerous moment. And this is something that a lot of people have warned about, including Mr. Lavrov, who said if this keeps spiraling, then, you know, an accident might be interpreted as a provocation or a provocation as an accident. And we don't know anymore what's happening. And I do not believe that the decision makers in Moscow, in Washington, and even the satellites in Kiev and Brussels and so on, that all of them are on the same page. This is why it is imperative, absolutely imperative, to get back to negotiations now, because we are running closer and closer to a Gulf of Tonkin moment or one of these sparks that can really cause another general European war or a third world war.
Yeah, well, and Dan, you know, when a president of the United States, even if he's a candidate for re-election, finds himself in very deep trouble. I have to watch my language here. Focusing the world's the public attention on foreign policy is always one of those things you can do here. It really bothers me very much, including everything we've said here, is that there is a path forward. I mean, the Russians have said, we have a starting point. Now, you may not like the starting point. I get that. Okay, I get it. Okay, it's called negotiations. Hey, we draw the line in the sand here. Let's start from that point. Okay, the West refuses to even to put up anything except for this ridiculous Zelensky program. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, we have to be reminded that back in March of 2022, there was a deal on the table that apparently Zelensky would have been willing to accept, which would allow the Ukraine to keep all of its territory that the U.S. and U.K. blocked. You know, the truth is that deal's off the table. They're not going to get back. Well, they'll never get back Crimea, and they won't get back to Donbass, certainly, nor should they, in my own view. And the U.S. and the West are going to have to wake up to that. You know, but you mentioned that, yeah, that a president that's in trouble and Biden's in trouble, they like to focus elsewhere to try to be able to win. But, you know, one way to focus elsewhere, how about bringing peace to somewhere? You know, idea that you got to start a war to win is ridiculous. The American people, the polls show, they want peace. They don't want to keep supporting Ukraine. They want the U.S. to stop supporting Israel's war in Gaza. You know, why can't the administration wake up to the fact that maybe making peace could be a winning strategy for them?
Well, I mean, Pascal, I mean, if we look at the recent elections in Europe, the peace proposal is something that is far more positive. I mean, we see a political party after political party supporting the American position on Ukraine. They suffer at the polls, okay, badly. And we're going to see one in the UK this week as well. That will probably go, both parties are very pro-war. But we've seen this in the European elections, that there's a lot of anxiety about where the European Union is going, always towing the American line. Pascal.
That is true. On the other hand, unfortunately, it's not enough yet. I mean, the centrist parties that are basically pro-war in across the board in Europe still have something between 50 to 60% of support. The 40% that they lost is pretty huge compared to where they are coming from, but it is not huge enough in order to be a landslide to kind of kick them out of power, which is what we're seeing in the UK. And like, you change from one pro-war party to the other one. And while support is eroding, the inertia of the system is still strong enough to keep the people who actually want to push forward the war in power, and that's a tremendous problem. And I would hope that at some point they understand that they need to change the narrative and they need to become pro-peace in order to remain there. But this, you know, it's a ship and it's still on course, and I don't know if we can avoid the iceberg on time, although it seems as if, though, the general public wants to steer it away.
Well, to continue your metaphor, Pascal, I mean, we all see the iceberg. For everyone can see, just like we saw during that debate, everybody can see what's going on here. Dan, you just said moments ago that the Donbass should not be returned to Ukraine. Explain.
Well, I've been to the Donbass, Peter, three times in the last year and a half. And I can tell you that those folks don't want to go back to Ukraine. And why? Because Ukraine began attacking those people, began attacking their own people. They were their own people at that time. They were part of Ukraine. And they attacked them because they were Russian-speaking people. And 14,000 people died in that conflict between Kiev and the Donbass, even before the special military operations began in 2022. I think, you know, once Ukraine went down that road, attacking its own people in the Donbass, it ceded any right to have that as part of Ukraine. In any case, these are historical parts of Russia. These, you know, the Donbass was the backbone of the Russian Revolution, of the Civil War, and frankly, of the Soviet Union, and of Russia, you know, was the industrial heartland. And, you know, they're not going back. They never want to go back. And their wishes should be respected.
Yeah, well, self-determination is something that we hear a lot about here. Pascal, what country threatens Ukraine more, Russia or the United States?
Russia is the one that bombs the Ukrainians, and the United States is the one that drives the Ukrainians into the Russian bayonets. So if I was Ukrainian, I would probably hate both of them. I mean, if I was Western Ukrainian.
That's fair. Yeah, keep going.
No, it's an absolutely horrible thing. I mean, the Ukrainians are the greatest victims. I mean, everyday Ukrainians are the greatest victims of this. The second victim is the Russians. And the ones that I wish were more humane would be the warmongers, the neocons in the United States, to actually understand that, no, we are playing with human lives here. But that's something that I think does not cross their minds, because they still see this as a strategic victory, which, in all fairness, it is. The U.S. has never been in a better place in the European theater of geopolitics than now, even in the last 30 years. I mean, switch off a strategic competitor check, get the Europeans all behind you, even to what you want to do in China check. I mean, this is a huge U.S. victory, but it comes with the blood of the Ukrainians.
Yeah, well, Dan, I agree with Pascal, but I, even though the United States has gone through the check that Pascal did, I don't think that's necessarily good for Europe, and I think a lot of European voters are beginning to realize that. Dan.
Yeah, well, I mean, Europe lost its lifeline, which was natural gas from Russia. I mean, and that's what partly what the U.S. wanted to do in this conflict, is to cut them off from that. So that they depend on U.S. natural gas, which, because of transportation costs, will be a lot more expensive. If I were a German in particular, I would be just absolutely furious that my economy had been wrecked, not by Russia, but by the United States. And look, the people in Europe are waking up to this. The elections in France show that. I mean, I think the elections turn out the way they did in large part because of France's terrible foreign policy in regards to both Russia and Israel. And you're going to see more governments fall in Europe as they realize they've been sold a bill of goods by the United States.
Pascal, what is next year between now and the election? Because everybody uses that as a benchmark here. You know, we have to wait up until the election, but what happens after the election in the United States? Nobody talks about that. Go ahead, Pascal.
Ideally, something would change, right? Ideally, we would move toward final reconciliation with Russia and de-escalation with China. But to me, I think that's probably my inner fairy tale land. Because what we have seen coming out of previous elections in the United States is that the permanent state carries on. So I have no objective hope, judging from past elections, that something is fundamentally going to change. Maybe, in the best case, we will see a de-escalation with Russia, but that would probably mean a refocusing of U.S. efforts to China, which might be an even bigger catastrophe over time.
We're rapidly running out of time, but Dan, Ukraine's on its last legs. You can make that case here, but NATO is not on its last legs. People have to remember that, and this conflict is not going to be over for quite a bit of time. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, that's right. You know, I mean, of course, candidate Donald Trump is talking about making peace in Ukraine. He says he can do it in 24 hours. Could be taken as bluster. Look, he made good, noises before the 2020 election and really did not become a friend of Russia, I think, because of pressure from the deep state.
Well,
and
you know, Dan, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I'll leave you with this thought with both of you. Even if Donald Trump gets elected, which I think is very unlikely in the way the system is designed, but they'll impeach him before he's inaugurated, even if he wins. Just I'll leave that with that thought with both of you. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Pittsburgh and in Kyoto. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.